actors in the on the internet. So one of the things that we have been trying to do is get a sense of what is really happening in the country. And I'll conclude by just saying that one of my own concerns, and I'm sure that this is something that Behrouz would echo as well, having had this experience himself in the 1980s, but as a scholar of prisons and prisoners, I'm quite worried about what the situation is inside of Iran's prisons. There were some reports from political prisoners in the country saying that there was limited access to food. This is a captive population, so if bombs are falling, they are captive to where they are, and they're also going to be sort of privy to whatever the authorities in Iran choose to do as well, including any sort of retaliation that they may choose to undertake. So that's something I'm keeping my eye on right now. There hasn't been any specific news out of prisons beyond some worry about food being limited, but there is a concern about this population.
I wanted to ask Professor Behrouz Ghamari about this comment of the reporter Jonathan Karl, who said, "President Trump told me tonight the U.S. had identified possible candidates to take over Iran, but they were killed in the initial attack." Trump told me, Jonathan Karl said, "The attack was so successful, it knocked out most of the candidates. It's not going to be anybody we were thinking of because they're all dead. Second or third place is dead," he said. So I wanted to go through who some of the possible candidates are, and maybe you could elaborate. You've got Mojtaba Khamenei, who is the son of the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, who is killed. You've got Alireza Arafi, director of Iran's religious seminaries, Mohammad Mahdi Mirbagheri, an ultra-hardline cleric, and among others. Also, Hassan Khamenei, the grandson of Ayatollah Khomeini, who
Yes.
died before Khamenei.
Yes. I don't think that the Iranian state is in any rush to appoint a successor to Ayatollah Khamenei at this point. They have a council
Because they're concerned he'll be killed.
Yes, and also it would be a rushed decision, and that decision has to be made by the assembly of experts, and they have to find time for a meeting of the assembly of experts to appoint the successor of Ayatollah Khamenei. And I think that the council that my colleague Gulnar just mentioned is appointed there to take care of the leadership issues at this point. And so far they are able to maintain a succession of leadership and at the very highest levels. And I don't believe that any of these candidates that you named are going to be one of those candidates that they are going to replace Ayatollah Khamenei. The most important person that people talk about is the person, the cleric from the Supreme Court, the Guardians Council. Ayatollah Arafi, who is a religious leader, not much of a political actor, but very respected in the seminaries. So at this point, people are mostly talking about him. But that's yet to be seen, that how this transfer of power would happen. But I do not think that they are in a rush to appoint a successor to Ayatollah Khamenei, because the structure of leadership is in place, and they were expecting this for a long time, and they are going to take their time before announcing any successor to Khamenei. Whether or not the Trump administration is in conversation with people inside Iranian political power, this sort of Venezuela model, we don't know. They're all speculation whether or not they're talking about to people about the possible successor who would be friendlier to American interests in the region. But at this point, these are all the speculations.
What about the president, the current Iranian president, Pezeshkian, who's believed to be alive?
Yes, but he is not going to be appointed as the supreme leader. The supreme leader needs to be coming from the ranks of the clergy. So he is not going to be appointed in that position. The person who is very important at this point, as Gulnar mentioned, is Ali Larijani, who is the head of the National Security Council. And he's been very, very active, and he's pretty much in charge of the affairs at this point, with consultation with the Council of Leadership that is in place right now.
And what about Reza Pahlavi, the son of the Shah, known for his brutal rule through his secret police, the Savak?
Reza Pahlavi basically is a Israeli-American project, and in the recent months, he's been gaining support inside.
Where is he?
He is in the U.S. He lives in Maryland, but he's traveling, trying to gain support from American politicians and the U.S. Congress and some Europeans. And he has a significant support among Iranian diaspora, and but this has been a project for in the making for many years, and millions and millions of dollars have been poured into making Reza Pahlavi an alternative to the Islamic Republic. Whether or not he can emerge as the real alternative, we don't know, but I doubt it.
Professor Gulnar Nikpour, you wrote a piece for Jacobin last year, The Fail Son and the Flag. Explain.
Yes, in that piece, I essentially argued, as Behrouz just did so ably, that Reza Pahlavi is fundamentally an Israeli-American project, as he just said. He has been the sort of hope of the neo-monarchist movement for many years and indeed decades, but has never been able to build organizational support, institutional support within Iran. That doesn't mean that he doesn't have supporters, of course. Largely in the diaspora, he's an important political figure in the diaspora, maybe the important political figure, and presumably some supporters in the country as well. But no institutional kind of entrenchment, right? No organization or political party or council that can be imagined as having state-like functions and stepping in to fill a power vacuum. To bring Reza Pahlavi, who himself in an interview not very long ago said that he can't even imagine moving back to Iran full time because his life is in the United States. He said this on a right-wing podcast in the U.S. a couple of years ago. And this is a figure that just does not have connections, organic connections to political movements in the country. So for him to emerge either as a transitional leader, which is what he says that he wants to be, or as a long-term leader, would need, in my view, significant military investment on the part of outside powers to prop up his rule. Boots on the ground, because there is a strong military apparatus and institutional apparatus in Iran, of the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guards, and Reza Pahlavi doesn't have a kind of comparable institutional support in the country. So to imagine bringing him to power would need a great deal of military support. This is what he has been essentially sort of on the vaccine advocating for, but has, to my knowledge, not managed to quite convince the Trump administration.
Professor Behrouz Ghamari, let me ask you a question because we begin to wrap up about Iran retaliating by sending drones to Israel, by going after the Gulf states one after another, and the significance of this, where you'd think they would want not to alienate these Gulf states, but now, if you can explain the attacks on Saudi Arabia, on UAE, on Qatar, on Bahrain, now apparently on Cyprus, you know, there's a British base on Cyprus.
Right. Iran is primarily targeting the U.S. bases in these countries, and many of these missiles are targeting Iran from the Saudi soil, from the UAE, from Kuwait, and Iran has forewarned them that they should not allow the U.S. to launch its attack from their soil, and it's the case that obviously when they start attacking, there are damages that happens outside the American bases. But primarily, that's the objective, to attack American bases in these countries. And they also want to expand the war. And Ayatollah Khamenei last week mentioned that if there is an attack on Iran, it's going to be a regional war. And this regional war, they want to make sure that they create an expansive war that is felt by the entire region and globally, because then they are going to disrupt the flow of oil. They are going to show Europeans primarily that they cannot sit on the sidelines without taking a position against this illegal act of aggression.
We just got news that the wife of the Supreme Leader, Ali Khamenei, has also succumbed to her injuries. She has died. We know that also killed in that attack, aside from the close to 50 commanders, was Khamenei's daughter and also grandchild. Your final thoughts. Again, you're a professor here in the United States now, but you were imprisoned at Evin prison. You were on death row. What's going to happen now, and why you feel so strongly that you are though you are a deep critic of this regime, that this war on Iran is wrong?
Because I think, you know, I can't find any reason to celebrate the assassination of the Iranian supreme leader, because I think it's part of a package. It's a package, because the assassination of the Iranian supreme leader is also part of the killing of Iranian school children. It's also part of the killing of Iranian innocent people. It's also part of the attack on Iranian hospitals. These are not separate issues, and I think that for that very reason, I don't think there is any reason to celebrate the demise of Iranian leader, because it's happening in the hands of what I call the king of genocide, and someone in the U.S. who's so deeply in trouble with the American legal system, with the Epstein files, and so for as many people say that this is Epstein war, and I think that we should not be sort of fools to think that this is in any shape or form is done on behalf of Iranian people. This is done on behalf of American, and primarily on behalf of Israeli interests. And I think Americans should ask themselves that why exactly are we attacking Iran without any kind of provocation? This is a war that is not in the interest of the United States, and is only fulfills and realizes the desires of a regime in Israel that is promoting forever wars in the region.
I want to thank you both for being with us, Behrouz Ghamari Tabrizi, fellow at the Center for Place, Culture, and Politics at the CUNY Graduate Center. His latest book, The Long War in Iran, New Events, Old Questions. He's previously professor and chair of the Department of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton, where he directed the Center for Iran and Persian Gulf Studies, was imprisoned at Evin prison in the 1980s, on death row there. And Gulnar Nikpur, associate professor of modern Iranian history at Dartmouth College, author of The Incarcerated Modern Prisons and Public Life in Iran. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we go to Tel Aviv and also look at Europe and how it's responding right now to the U.S.-Israeli attack on Iran. Stay with us.
Stand behind his drunken amp. Stand behind his light of love. Hear him yowl his their tongue. Hear 'em yellow, blood and war. Do you believe in his sweet sensation? Do you believe in second chance? Do you believe in rapture, babe?
Do you believe in rapture by Thurston Moore, performing at Smith College in 2005? This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman, as we continue to look at the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. Israel's mobilized 100,000 reservists as it threatens to reinvade Lebanon. Lebanon's health ministry says at least 31 people have been killed, nearly 150 wounded, since Israel launched renewed airstrikes in Beirut suburbs and other parts of Lebanon on Sunday. Tens of thousands of residents of southern and eastern Lebanon were seen fleeing their homes after Israel ordered people in nearly 50 villages to evacuate. Israel's military says its renewed war in Lebanon comes in response to missiles and drones fired by Hezbollah in retaliation for the assassination of Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. They were Hezbollah's first major violations of a ceasefire that took effect in November 2024. During that time, the UN peacekeeping force in Lebanon, known as UNIFIL, documented more than 15,000 ceasefire violations committed by Israel. Israeli police say 9 people were killed after an Iranian missile attack on the central city of Beit Shemesh. Another strike killed a woman in Tel Aviv. This is Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu speaking Sunday.
We are in a campaign in which we are bringing the full force of the IDF, as never before, to ensure our existence and our future. But we are also bringing into this campaign the assistance of the United States, my friend, U.S. President Donald Trump, and the U.S. military. And this combination of forces enables us to do what I have long hoped to do for 40 years, to strike the terror regime decisively. That is what I promised, and that is what we will do.
We're joined right now by Uri Goldberg, Israeli political analyst, scholar in Tel Aviv, written extensively on Iran, Israel, and the relationship between religion and politics in the Middle East. Uri, thanks so much for being with us again. You were there for our special broadcast on Saturday. Can you talk about the response on the ground right now in Israel to the Israeli-U.S. attack on Iran, and then the response by Iran?
Well, as far as the Israeli general population goes, there is a broad embrace of this attack. In fact, the consensus, which so far during the protests against the Netanyahu government has been shushed and actively repressed, is now surfacing with full strength. That is the alliance between the Israeli liberals and the Israeli right, the settlers, the religious elements in the government. They all seem to agree broadly and deeply that this war is inevitable, that it must be carried out right now, and that it has and Israel has absolutely no choice. And of course, that this war will only end with a real toppling of the regime in Tehran, a campaign that can and should last as long as it takes, which is something our prime minister has said repeatedly over the last few days. The population is resigned to this war. It supports it. It doesn't appear to be jubilant. Nobody's accepting Netanyahu's boasts like they did after the IDF mobilized and invaded Gaza following the events of October 2023. But there's a sense that this has to be done, and we're doing what has to be done.
And what about the call for 100,000 Israeli reservists for the possible reinvasion of Lebanon?
Well, the Israeli government mobilizes reservists with great ease, certainly now when the entire country is at a shutdown. It might have been a little more difficult had the country been in full working mode, but it most certainly is not. Most Israelis are shuttling between shelters and taking care of kids who are home from school, as the educational system is not working either. Mobilizing 100,000 reservists, as I said, is not that difficult. Will Israel invade Lebanon? Particularly when we hear that the Lebanese prime minister has officially declared that the government of Lebanon forbids Hezbollah from operating in any sort of military capacity from Lebanese territory. I doubt very much that we will see another invasion of Lebanon. Israel so far seems quite pleased to be attacking, bombing, killing, and destroying from the air, just as is the case with the United States in Iran.
How many times have you been sent into shelter, Uri? On Saturday, I think it was, we were up to 12 by the time we spoke at about 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yes, and then I think we got to about 20, but it hasn't really improved. The frequency has somewhat lessened, but we can get one sheltering order in place, then have it rescinded after 10 minutes, and then after 2 minutes, have it on again. Classically, overcompensation for the beginning of the Gaza, quote-unquote, war. When the IDF and the Israeli state were caught completely unprepared. Now the powers that be here seem to have reached a decision that it's better to send the entire country into shelters than to have even one unnecessary casualty.
Can you talk about the negotiations that were happening in Geneva around Iran's nuclear program, this happening in the midst of them as they were planning to continue this week? This is something that you've looked at continually.
I'm not going to go off on a speculative tangent. I cannot corroborate this completely or positively. But to the best of my understanding, this was not the result of an operation meant to misdirect Iranian attention or meant to secure reasons for a preventive attack. If it was, then this isn't a preventive attack. If this has been planned for months and years, then there's no doubt that there's nothing preventive or legal about it. What I gather is that there was some convergence of intelligence. There was a realization that Iran's senior leadership was going to meet in a somewhat unprecedented fashion in Tehran. This is the sort of tactical intelligence at which Israel excels. Israelis brought this to the attention of the United States. The forces were already in place because, again, moving forces is easier than sending them into an actual war. Same case for the United States as it is for Israel. So the forces were already in place, and all that was needed was the spark of that particular meeting where Israel and the United States believed that they could assassinate the supreme leader of the Islamic Republic. They succeeded in everything that has happened since, pretty much, ever since the opening shock and awe enhanced, as it were, has, I think, been learning and working in motion. Targets have all been identified for months and years. There's no doubt that's the case. But any kind of coherent, consequent logic that would be apparent in such a program, any kind of final goal, any kind of vision as to what regime change might actually include, that does not seem to be a part of either the Israeli or the American working plan in Iran at the moment. And in fact, President Trump could declare victory whenever he so chooses. He's already assassinated the supreme leader. Israel could declare victory whenever it so chooses. But Israel, over the past 2.5 years, has become exceedingly greedy. It doesn't want to commit itself to anything. It actually, I think, what Israel is fighting for is the right to be able to go off on such attacks whenever it wants, wherever it wants, for as long as it wants. So don't expect Israel to come to a political realization that this might end. Again, the population supports Prime Minister Netanyahu. The opposition has officially disbanded itself and declared that there were no coalition or opposition now, just the united people of Israel. So don't look to Israel for any kind of political statement.
Uri Goldberg, I want to thank you for being with us, Israeli political analyst and scholar in Tel Aviv. When we come back, we go to war crimes prosecutor Reed Brody. Stay with us.
In the Haggadi forsaken, got no reason to cry. You got to chew the angels falling from on high. waiting for no answer, baking woeful pie. Pie of eyesight, pie blue black. Oh, that pie, the pie of pie and pie. In the Hoggarty Forsaken, he will leave you one more chance.
Folk musician Michael Hurley, Hog of the Forsaken. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The United States and Israel are facing global condemnation for launching unilateral attacks on Iran without seeking approval of the UN Security Council. We go now to France, where we're joined by Reid Brody, longtime war crimes prosecutor, member of the International Commission of Jurists, author of To Catch a Dictator. Reid, if you can respond to what has taken place, the U.S.-Israeli attacks on Iran and then Iran retaliating by sending missiles and drones throughout the Gulf and against Israel.
Sure, Amy. I mean, look, whatever you think of the theocratic dictatorship in Iran, these attacks by the U.S. and Israel are a clear violation of the foundational principle of the post-war legal order, which is the non-use of force. The U.N. Charter is not ambiguous. Article 2, Section 4 prohibits the use of force against the territorial integrity or the political independence of any state. And there are only two exceptions. One, if the Security Council authorizes it, which obviously nobody sought here, or self-defense. And that means self-defense in response to an actual or an imminent armed attack. And here there was no, it's obvious, there was no such imminent attack. President Trump even said last year that he had obliterated Iran's nuclear capacity. As you've reported, both sides had just concluded the most intensive round of nuclear talks. So there was no, you know, immediate threat here. And so President Trump has presumptively committed the crime, the international crime of aggression, as he did in Venezuela, and just as Vladimir Putin did in Ukraine. And at the Nuremberg trials, the supreme international crime was considered to be aggression, crimes against peace. It's also important to remember that under U.S. law, as you've put it, the Constitution gives Congress, not the president, the power to declare war. And this is not some quaint historical debate. The framers were very cognizant that executives, that kings start war, and that war is the most consequential decision that a nation can take. And it should not be left to a single person's judgment. The framers had seen the alternative, the royal prerogative of bringing a war. And that was precisely the kind of tyranny they wanted to avoid, that one person on a whim or for whatever. I mean, obviously, they had not, I don't think the founders ever imagined that they would have a president who would launch a war because he was dropping in the polls or because he wanted to divert from the Epstein files or because he didn't get the Nobel Peace Prize. But, you know, it is a foundational principle here that the president cannot just decide to go to war. He can do it in an emergency. And that's why the Constitution says doesn't say that only the Congress can make war. Because they allow the president in the case of an emergency, but not to declare war and keep a war going.
We have 10 seconds. President Trump now told The Atlantic magazine they want to talk, and I've agreed to talk, so I'll be talking to them. As the U.S. and Israel strikes Iran hundreds of times, and apparently the Pentagon, the president is saying this will go on for weeks.
But, you know, I mean, we're shifting. I mean, this shows that there was no plan here. The whole reason, I mean, one of the main reasons to have, this constitutional provision is so that a war can be deliberated. So you understand what a war is about. You go to the people, you go to the Congress,
deliberate,
and you decide as a nation there should be a war or there shouldn't be.
Reid Brody, war crimes prosecutor, member of the International Commission of Jurists. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Broadcasting on the internet and at 90.1 FM from high atop Burnaby Mountain, you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.
With Canada's health system under strain, going digital can help heal our healthcare. From virtual visits for everyday concerns to faster, more accurate diagnostics powered by AI, technology is transforming care. Digital Health Canada supports the people and innovations behind this change. Learn more at digitalhealthcanada.com and subscribe to our podcast.
Love to tell